From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Today we're featuring another series of interviews from our program archives. Consider how long it's taken this planet and the human race to evolve, and then consider the startling changes in our lives which can be attributed to technology over the last quarter century. Simply speaking, not enough time has passed to truly comprehend the total impact this massive infusion of technology has had on our lives. For over 25 years, Paul Brodeur has been a staff writer for The New Yorker. His four books on asbestos have won major awards and were instrumental in making the public aware of its dangers. His latest book is The Great Powerline Cover-Up, in which he turns his attention to electromagnetic fields. We'll discuss the health problems and the groundswell of citizen action around this issue. Later, I'll speak with David Sheff. He's the author of Game Over, Nintendo Zapped an American Industry, Captured Your Dollars, and Enslaved Your Children. We'll discuss his views about why Nintendo games have such a mesmerizing hold on our youth, and we'll look at what is known about the behavioral effects associated with playing video games. Paul Brodeur's book, The Great Powerline Cover-Up, talks about the electrical power lines which have been built in the United States since World War II and the effects of the electromagnetic fields which they create. I asked him why daily and constant exposure is not healthy for humans.
We evolved as human beings in a direct current magnetic field on Earth. But only in this century have we been exposed to 60 hertz alternating current. That means current that vibrates to and fro 60 times a second. That's how our whole electric distribution system works. And as one famous oncologist said recently, and as most scientists know, when you're standing beneath a high voltage or high current power line giving off strong magnetic fields, every molecule in your brain and body is vibrating back and forth 60 times a second. Well, now, that's never happened in human evolution, and it doesn't take an electronic wizard or even a medical doctor to figure out that in the long term, day in and day out, with chronic exposure, that may not be very good for you. And in fact, there are 60 human studies, most of which illustrate that it is not only not good for you, but that it causes a statistically significant increased cancer in children and adults exposed at home or at work to power line magnetic fields.
Now, we're not talking about just walking through this once a day for a minute.
No, because whenever you talk about occupational or environmental disease, whether it's exposure to asbestos or to chlorinated hydrocarbon pesticides or chemicals, you're almost invariably talking about long-term chronic exposure. Now, the electric utility industry has been trying to scare people and drag a red herring through this and obfuscate this issue by pointing out that appliances, many home appliances, give off strong magnetic fields, and in fact, they do. If you take your hairdryer, for example, and put a Gauss meter, that's a device for measuring the magnetic field, right up against the housing, you'll get a strong magnetic field. But because of the size of the coil in the appliance, when you pull the measuring device away an inch or two, the field drops off drastically. But even more important than that, you don't hang out with your hairdryer 8 hours a day. You don't sit on your vacuum cleaner, and you don't curl up to your electric toaster or coffee maker. We're talking, you know, we're all exposed intermittently to asbestos, to chemicals, and of course to magnetic fields from appliances, mostly our fingertips. What is the problem here are devices that expose you long-term and chronically. The power lines, when they are built close to schools or to homes or to offices, either high voltage or high current power lines, they give off strong magnetic fields that invade those homes and offices and schools for 24 hours a day. And there are a few things that you have to be careful about. You have to be careful about your video display terminal, but if you sit an arm's length, the fingertips extended from that, you're not going to have a problem because the magnetic field doesn't extend out further than that. And the electric blankets, which were a big problem, they're almost out of sight now. I mean, they've been withdrawn from the market or they have been redesigned.
You tell the story of the effects of this exposure by looking at a number of real stories. Let's start out with the story of Meadow Street.
Well, after I wrote my initial book, I'm a staff writer at the New Yorker magazine, have been for 35 years, and after I wrote my initial pieces on the power line problem, which were the first major pieces ever written in 1989, and they became a book called Currents of Death, I got about 5,000 letters and phone calls over the next 3 or 4 years from people who were concerned about this or that. And many of them were from people who were concerned because they lived on streets like Meadow Street, which is only 200 yards long, has only 9 houses on it, where there was an extraordinary amount of brain cancer. You have 5 or 6 brain cancers in that street, as well as other cancers. And it's a very stable population. It was a blue-collar street in a little town in Guilford, Connecticut. And people didn't move away, and there was a substation on the street. A substation is where high voltage comes in. You understand that high voltage is the, you want to think of electricity as water in a garden hose. Voltage is the pressure that pushes it across the countryside from the nuclear generating station. But you couldn't bring that high voltage into a city, because if you did try to bring it into a building, you'd burn everything up. So you have to step it down at transformer stations called substations, and the transformers actually transform the voltage into current. Current is the juice that goes out on high current distribution wires and then spreads out in this great vast spider web of the electric distribution system with low current wires. And where your problem is with the high voltage wires coming into your cities, or with the high current distribution, the trunk lines really, that send out the high current from the substations. It's not with the low current wires which comprise most of the distribution system. Well, on this Meadow Street, there was a substation. High voltage was coming into the substation, and right along this little street within 30 feet of these houses went some very high current distribution wires that were supplying current for a distant load area for 30 miles up the coast. So these people were exposed to the magnetic fields given off by all the current that was supplying a huge load area, thousands of homes. So there were very strong magnetic fields. And wherever you have this situation, whether it's in a school like the Slater Elementary School in Fresno, which is within 100 feet of a 115,000-volt power line, and you've got 15 cases of cancer among the teachers and administrative personnel on that one side of the school and none on the other, or whether it's the Montague Elementary School down here in Santa Clara, 35 miles from San Francisco, where you've got high-voltage lines near the schools, or whether it's across the country, in North Carolina, where you had people who lived in the factory town near the Duke power plant, they have an extraordinary incidence of brain cancer. You're going to find increased leukemia, lymphoma, brain cancer, breast cancer in men, which is a frightening thing because of its implications for women, and I'd like to talk about that later. You're going to find increased incidence of cancer of all types, probably, but especially those, because the experimental studies clearly show that the magnetic fields suppress the immune system. They suppress the ability of the T lymphocyte cells, which are the soldiers of the immune system, to combat cancer.
Now, are children especially susceptible?
The Swedish government, which has acknowledged a year ago, almost to the day, that power line magnetic fields are a cause of cancer in humans, believes that children are especially susceptible. And the 9 or 8 or 9 studies that have been done in this country and around the world, studying the exposure of children in residences close to power lines indicate that they are susceptible. And it's only natural. Here you've got this agent, the magnetic field, an invisible line of force, vibrating 60 times a second. Everything in its path, nothing can shield it, goes right through concrete, wood, anything else, and of course the human body. All the molecules of the human body will be entrained to that rhythm, vibrating back and forth 60 times a second. And a child, his cells are dividing so rapidly, particularly the hematopoietic cells, the blood-forming cells and the brain cells, you can imagine that this simply would affect them. It stands to reason. Logic tells you so. But the utility companies, and unfortunately the state health departments of many states and the federal government, want people to think that the jury is still out on this. Well, that's absurd. There are 60 human studies done around the world, all of them published in the peer-reviewed medical literature. More than 50% of them are statistically significant increase of cancer. 80% of them show some association. Only 15% are negative, and of those 15%, almost all have been conducted by the electric utility industry. I mean, you know, wake up. It's there in front of you. The Environmental Protection Agency issued a report 3 years ago our Environmental Protection Agency, stating that power line magnetic fields were a probable cause of cancer in humans. They particularly mentioned children. That means more likely than not. And since then, the Bush administration and now the Clinton administration has been trying desperately to suppress that information.
You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans in Technology. I'm Moira Gunn, and my guest today is Paul Brodeur. He is author of the book, The Great Powerline Cover-Up, How the Utilities and the Government Are Trying to Hide the Cancer Hazards Posed by Electromagnetic Fields. What amazes me is the reactions of school boards and authorities. They say, we will take no action until the situation is unequivocally proven to be dangerous. Well, what about, these are our children? There are some findings and there's some common sense. We will not expose them until the situation is definitively proven to be safe.
Well, of course, this is ignorant, stupid, I mean, in my view, criminally stupid, but here's what's happening. Here's the reason for it, first of all. Your school boards, and I have had experience with them now in about 10 different states, say this to begin with because they talk to their lawyers, and their attorneys say, listen, fella, you close off these classrooms or you take any steps to acknowledge that this is a problem, a parent with a child with cancer or a teacher who's developed cancer or an administrator personnel can sue you, and the school board will be, the school district will be a target defendant. So just as with the electric utility industry, they want to deny this. And people, either the CEOs of the electric utility industry or the members of that school board, can't wait to just keep the lid on this until they get out of there, go on to some other job, until the responsibility leaves them. Now, what's happening all over the country is that parents and teachers aren't standing for this. At the Slater Elementary School in Fresno, California, the parents and the teachers simply went before the school and said, hey, listen, we've got too much cancer in the school. You're going to do something about it. And the school board said, yes, we should do something. And they closed down the school. They closed down that side of the school. They did the same thing at the Montague Elementary School in Santa Clara. They're doing the same thing back east in New York State, for example. Attorney General Robert Abrams ordered, or persuaded, perhaps, a better word, the utility industry, who directed them, really, to measure the magnetic fields at all the state schools that were within 100 feet of high-voltage power lines. The authorities in New Jersey have done the same thing. Why aren't the attorney generals in other states doing this? It's a question of knowledge among the people, and that kind of pressure that comes from the people to the authorities. See, if that pressure didn't come, the authorities would never do anything about this for one very simple reason. Once any state or federal health official acknowledges, as the Swedish health officials and government had done, that this is a problem, then they've got to do something about it. They can't just say, this is a cancer hazard, and then walk away from it. Well, they desperately don't want to do anything about it because they are afraid that this is open-ended. They don't know the extent of this problem. None of us do. It's got to be pervasive, it's got to be big, and it's got to be expensive. The Clinton administration, the Bush administration, openly tried to suppress the EPA report. Then they set up all these phony committees to review the literature and say that there's no problem. The Clinton administration has gone along with this. Vice President Gore, 2 years ago, asked the EPA to come to his Senate office when he was senator. They measured the magnetic fields there. They found a very dangerously high level there. Presumably something was done about it. In any event, we know, because it's been published, that Senator Gore took the measuring device home and measured his home. He hasn't said a thing about this since then, since becoming vice president, except that 2 months ago he went before C-SPAN. And he told people that according to the Bush administration science, Office of Science and Technology report, there was no problem. Well, there is a problem. The chapter on the human studies of that report was written by a scientist who's a paid consultant of the electric utility industry. And so this is where we are here. And this is why I've called my book, The Great Powerline Cover-Up.
Why are the schools so much at risk? How could that have happened?
Well, interestingly, particularly in new states like California, not so true of New England where I live much of the year, but in California, for example, and in other parts of the country, school districts have always bought the cheapest land for their schools. And where is the cheapest land in any community? Well, for aesthetic reasons, it's always been near the power lines or next to the power line corridors. So in California, you've got schools, many schools, but in many other states too, not just California, built very close to power line corridors. In New Jersey, for example, I write in the book about schools in New Jersey that are sandwiched between huge high voltage lines. And the problem, of course, the medical problem is that here you're congregating children which everyone agrees are most vulnerable to these kinds of fields, in classrooms where they're exposed for hours on end each day. Some of those children, God forbid, may even be going home to homes where they are also heavily exposed because the homes are next to high voltage or high current lines. So what we have to do in this country is behave intelligently the way I think the Swedes have done. First of all, we have to acknowledge that there's a problem. Then we have to identify where it exists in its most correctable and importantly correctable form. And then we have to set about to remedy it. I mean, that's what an intelligent human being does, when an individual does when he gets sick, or he or she gets sick. He or she says, well, I'm sick. I acknowledge that I'm sick. I go to the doctor, identify, get it diagnosed, where it exists, and then I'll follow the doctor's orders and I'll remedy it. We haven't even got to square one in this country. The state and federal health authorities are pressured by the utility industry and by the executive branches because they're scared of the money, are saying, deny this, deny this. Say the jury's out. Keep denying it. Don't admit that there's a problem. This is crazy.
Now, you have indicated that there is success at the grassroots level when there have been some very substantial problems that couldn't be denied at the Slater School, for instance, or on Meadow Street. If I'm a parent and I have a child in a school, how do I go about finding out the status of my school?
Well, first of all, you can eyeball the school and know whether it's close within 150 feet of a high voltage or a high current power line. And if you think it is, then there are people who will measure all over the place. I mean, if you go to your school authorities and say, we want this school measured, they're going to have to do it, and they will do it. Sometimes there are problems in homes and in schools with wiring. That's not customary, but they can be easily resolved by fixing the wiring. As far as measuring in your home or school go, you always want to make sure that you measure with the current shut off as well as on, because when you have shut the current off, then you know for sure that whatever magnetic field reading you're getting in the school or home is an ambient field coming from the outside, i.e. the power lines, because there's no other source.
This is not a problem of the poor. Many times lead paint, it's like poor people live in old apartments. A school in Montecito, California, which is an extremely wealthy community, had this problem.
Yes, this problem cuts across all socioeconomic lines. I have seen within a half a mile where you'll have high magnetic fields in a mansion and literally in an immigrant hovel. People didn't know about it. The homes, particularly in California, have been built right in the power line corridors, often with great vistas of the ocean down in San Diego County, where I live part of the year. And that's one of the reasons that the government is not going to succeed in keeping a lid on this. It's very easy to keep a lid on problems like the big pesticide problems in McFarland for years and years, or the Stringfellow acid pits, you know, until something terrible happens. But it's not so easy to keep a lid on the problem when, and this is the other edge of this double-edged sword of the electromagnetic field problem, when not only one's children and oneself are at risk of disease, but when one's home is being devalued. And the litigation that's out there now in California, across the nation, for property devaluation is probably what is going to turn this whole thing around. People will stand for a lot, but the middle class in this country, and I suspect anywhere else in the world, will not tolerate its most precious commodity, its home, from being devalued. I always thought that people's most precious commodity was the health of their children until I wrote four or five books about asbestos disease over the last 25 years and realized that people often just are willing to forget disease. It's a sort of unthinkable. Anything can happen. Your children just, you know, deny it. But this business of not being able to sell a home, that's not so deniable, and people are really reacting strongly to that.
My guest today is Paul Brodeur. He is a writer for The New Yorker, and his work has earned him the National Magazine Award and an American Association for the Advancement of Science Award. I'm Moira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Paul, you wrote many books on asbestos, and we're familiar with how that became a major issue and affected the schools, affected people's homes. Are there similarities here with the asbestos situation?
Well, there are some similarities. One is a major attempt to deny the problem. But the asbestos problem was originally perceived of by the American public as an occupational problem, a workplace problem. Shipyard workers, construction workers, railway people, and asbestos products manufacturers and fabricators, insulators, these were blue-collar people who were dying at extraordinary rates of disease. It only became a major national problem when, once again, the middle class saw asbestos in its schools. And there was a huge hue and cry, and in 1986 the Congress passed laws mandating its removal. And now, of course, as you know, no architect in his right mind or construction engineer would use asbestos in any building in this country. There's been a de facto ban on it. So naturally, the industry has moved elsewhere, overseas to the Philippines, Thailand, India, and Guatemala, wherever, and Mexico, where, of course, the lungs of people are precisely the same as our lungs and where they're killing people wholesale. Now, you must remember that the asbestos problem was not resolved by the government, either the state or the federal government. What resolved the asbestos problem was the greatest toxic tort litigation in the history of world jurisprudence. There had never been anything like it before, and may never again until the Power Line litigation cranks up. You had tens upon tens of thousands of sick, dying, and disabled workers who could get no recourse from the state or federal government, because the state or federal governments, just as they are with the electric, with the power line magnetic fields, refused to really do anything about it and refused to take any preventive measures. So when the state and federal governments failed, health authorities failed to do their job, when the industry in question, as the asbestos industry did, denies it, stonewalls, the last recourse of the injured citizen is the law. So no one should be surprised that there was all this asbestos litigation. Now, of course, the system heals itself, and through the bankruptcy laws, these firms got out of paying what they should have, and the insurance industry did too, although, as we know now, Lloyd's of London is going belly up because of the $50 billion asbestos hit. My point is that the way we do things in this country, the way we deal with preventive measures to protect the public health, needs talk about the medical system needing redesigning. That's what needs redesigning in our country. The present administration quite correctly wants to deliver health care to the American people in a new way. I'm all for it. I think everybody is. But unfortunately, because of the economic considerations, it's got a case of myopia. Healthcare is not simply a question of affordable treatment. Much more important is prevention. And litigation does nothing to prevent disease because of the simple reason that by the time you can file a lawsuit, you've got to have a cause of action. You've got to have a child who's diseased, or you have to be diseased, or your home has to have lost value. That's no way to protect the public health. But that's the way we do things in America. And we've got to change that. And I think people are beginning to see that, particularly with this power line magnetic field problem, because, as we said earlier, it cuts across all socioeconomic lines.
In many of the stories in the book, in the various places in which we see this kind of problem, there is a constant discussion between the authorities and the citizenry who's concerned about whether or not there is a cluster. And the cluster, of course, means something artificial has happened to induce the cancer. One of the examples I'd like you to talk about is Slater School. One of the things that hit me there was they had twice the expected rate of cancer. This was explained by the person in charge as being coincidence. And then it occurred to me that when we're looking at expected rates of cancer, that in fact we're looking at how many cases in a general population. So that if you in fact have these artificial clusters of cancer, that the expected rate is actually much higher than that.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Let me say about the Slater School is that the state health authority, California state health authorities, diluted their whole risk ratio by not taking the fact that all the cancers occurred on one side of the school. They assumed that there was twice what would have occurred in the whole school. But a simple sign test will tell you. I mean, when they say that this is due to chance, that's ludicrous. A simple time test will show you, and any mathematician will tell you, that the chances of all 15 cancers occurring on the side of the school next to the power line is 1 in 2 to the 15th, or one in 32,750-something. Now, the other thing about this is that one of the high state officials in California, when this latest school thing was going on, went before the Fresno Rotarians. And he said, well, he said, he quoted some studies that have been done in this country, the Pioneer studies that showed that there was a 2 to 3-fold increased incidence of cancer in children who lived in homes near high current wires. And he said, and I quoted him, really, that's nothing that I would want to break into a sweat about. Well, first of all, that's a quintessentially ignorant remark for a public health official to make. But secondly, as any epidemiologist knows, if the risk is 2 to 3-fold in these studies, the actual risk is probably closer to 6 to 8 to 10 for one very simple reason. The studies do not compare exposed children to non-exposed children. The studies, all of them that have been done, simply compare children who have been exposed to more to children who have been exposed to less for the very simple reason that you cannot find a child in the modern industrial society who's non-exposed, or it's very difficult to. So in the case-control studies where they try to get children living in the same neighborhoods, the same areas of cities, either Denver or Los Angeles, where these studies have been done, they try to find them living, they do the case-control study. The very idea of the case-control study is that in order to weed out the other confounders of traffic or cigarette smoking or whatever else, you have to find children who are comparable, in comparable circumstances, so that if you take a look at the actual magnetic field measurements in these studies, you'll find that children in the high current homes who have the 2 to 3-fold risk only have a 2 to 3-fold risk over children in the lower current homes who nonetheless are significantly exposed. So if you were to take, in other words, exposed children to non-exposed, totally non-exposed children, you'd find a much higher rate, 6 to 8. So this idea of the utility industry and its apologists at the state and federal levels trying to say, well, you know, 2 to 3-fold, that isn't so bad when you think that only 1 in 10,000 children develops cancer and now it's only 2 to 3. It's much greater than that. Moreover, because the magnetic field acts as a promoter, probably not so much of a cause as a promoter, anybody who is prey to cancer because of say, another factor, say the children in McFarland, who we know were exposed heavily to pesticides, but you have this huge Voice of America transmitter, one of the most powerful radio frequency transmitters in the world there. Now, you don't have the kind of cancer that you had among those children probably without some other factor. So you have to look at cofactors. You remember in asbestos exposure, cigarette smoking was a tremendous cofactor. The idea that there's only one thing that causes cancer is crazy. While we're on this subject, I think it's worth noting that 4 recent studies show that men who work in power line magnetic fields, power linemen, telephone linemen, electricians, electronic engineers, are experiencing a 6-fold increase in male breast cancer. Now, male breast cancer is a vanishingly rare disease. It afflicts in the United States 1 in every 100,000 men each year. But as everybody in your audience knows, it's not a vanishingly rare disease in women. Indeed, between 1 in 8 and 9 women are developing breast cancer in their lifetimes, which is extraordinary. It's an epidemic. Now, breast cancer in men is histologically identical to breast cancer in women when you put the tissue under the microscope. So it seems to me that it stands to reason that something that is causing a significant increase in breast cancer in men, and the 6-fold may be greater, as I've already indicated, should be of enormous concern to American women who are now demanding that the government finally do something about this extraordinary epidemic of breast cancer. It certainly should be looked at very seriously as an undoubtedly a probable cofactor in the development of breast cancer in women.
There have been many accusations of irresponsible reporting generating mass hysteria. And whenever I see anyone accusing anyone else of generating mass hysteria, I always look at the accuser and I say, what do you have to lose? Who has what to lose over this?
Well, the electric utility industry, of course, because they've denied this so much, is now facing massive litigation. There are major personal injury lawsuits all across the country, and there are literally hundreds of property devaluation lawsuits growing by leaps and bounds daily. Major litigation will be filed next week in the Slater school case in Fresno, for example. So they have that to lose. As far as the accusations of sensational reporting, you know, I was called an alarmist and a sensationalist by the asbestos industry, of course, by DuPont and the other manufacturers of chlorofluorocarbons when I wrote about the ozone layer, by the electronic industry when I wrote about microwaves and radio frequency radiation. So it comes with the territory. You know, all of a sudden you're a sensationalist and an alarmist when you're writing about things that affect people's pocketbooks. The fact is that any reading will show that almost all of the great power line cover-up is written from the documentary evidence. For example, when a state public health official says that he was not going to break into a sweat about a 2 to 3-fold increase of cancer, I have the tape recording which he said that. When he says, or when another state official appears before in the Guilford Town Library with the utility and allows the utility to tell the citizens of the country, of the town, excuse me, that there's no problem on Meadow Street, I have the minutes of that meeting. And I have written this book out of that kind of documentary evidence. And when a journalist can write out the documentary evidence, he doesn't need to go and get the pro forma denials from the utility. I learned something many years ago, and I think most journalists know this. Whenever you want to know why someone is saying something or not saying something, or why someone is doing something or not doing something, you follow the money trail. It rarely leads you wrong.
Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest today has been Paul Brodeur. His book, The Great Power Line Cover-Up, How the Utilities and the Government Are Trying to Hide the Cancer Hazards Posed by Electromagnetic Fields, is published by Little Brown & Company. You're listening to TechNation, Americans and Technology. In his latest book, Game Over, David Sheff writes about the sudden and massive expansion of the video games industry and the impact which it's had on both the American economy and American society. I asked David what motivated him to write this book.
I have a son who is now 11, and when we first got the Nintendo system into our home, he was only about 5 or 6. And whereas the trend of the moment would come into the house, it would soon disappear. But this one didn't go away. He and his friends just got more and more immersed in video games, and he got more phone calls at night from friends calling up to ask for secret tips and to boast about getting to sort of a new world, or to ask him, you know, how do you kill the mini boss on level 14 of Super Mario 3 or something. And then I picked up the paper one day and saw that a survey had been done of American children, which concluded that more of them now recognize Nintendo's mascot Super Mario than recognize Mickey Mouse. And to me, that said something is going on and something dramatic is going on. And most people, at least most adults that I knew, had no idea. And so that caused me to look closer.
What could be bigger than Mickey Mouse?
That's right.
Well, in the early 80s, there were a number of American firms who were making a killing in video games. What happened? How did we get to Nintendo?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting story. Nintendo is a 100-and-some-odd-year-old company, but they were making playing cards for all those years, a really sort of beautiful and ancient game called Hanafuda that started out when craftsmen would paint images on shells and then it converted into a playing card game. When here in the 70s, the video game industry was really born. The first commercial video game was created by Nolan Bushnell, who founded Atari, and other American companies followed him into the business, Coleco and Mattel. And so in the early 1980s, there was an industry that grew to about $2.5 billion, maybe a little more than that. But they did a lot of things wrong. There were so many bad management decisions that it's sort of astounding. First of all, there was a lot of really young people at these companies that made an enormous amount of money. And so people like Bushnell and some of his cronies were off flying around on their own Learjets, entertaining movie stars and hanging out in restaurants in Paris instead of minding the store. And then Atari was sold to Warner Communications, a big, big conglomerate, who didn't have any idea how to sell a product to young boys, which is really the driving force of this market, of this whole world of video games. And they did a lot of stupid things. They came out with games that were, first of all, terrible. They made a game, for instance, based on the movie E.T. that was incomprehensible. And not only was it a terrible game and boring, which is the kiss of death for a video game, but they produced more of the games, of the E.T. games, than were systems out there in the market. So it was just, it was impossible, absolutely impossible to sell all that they'd made. And so they just didn't know what they were doing. And the industry went from a multi-billion-dollar industry to almost disappearing by about 1980, end of 1982, about 1983, there was nothing. It was in shambles. There was too many companies, software companies, retailers who'd lost enormous amounts of money, and so nobody wanted to touch video games with a 10-foot pole. When Nintendo, a few years later, came in and decided to ignore them all.
I'm old enough to remember our family's first television. And when my sister grew up, she grew up routinely watching television. And today kids watch TV and the VCR and they play Nintendo. How's this changing their lives?
Well, first of all, it is changing their lives. It's changing them dramatically. TV has been around long enough to know, for us to know, that that it has an enormous impact in the culture. I mean, it's just, it can't be overstated. It affects the way we think. It affects the way we relate to one another. It affects the way we consume. It affects the way that our children learn and grow. And video games, in some ways, and certainly psychologists have corroborated this, have more of an impact than television because of the attention that's required is so much greater. There are other things going on. Possible to go on in someone's brain when they're watching television, but when you're playing a video game as intently as these games are played by design, nothing else is going on. And because of that sort of linear thinking that's going on, first of all, there's a whole world that's being excluded to kids. When you think about kids going to school for 8 hours a day or whatever it is, or 7 hours a day, and then perhaps they have an hour of homework, and then there's perhaps a meal thrown in there. There's not that much time, yet studies I've seen have shown that kids are playing video games sometimes 3 and 4 hours a night on school nights, and sometimes more than that. And some families who would never imagine letting their kids watch TV for that much time set no limits when it comes to video game playing. So kids are playing, in some cases, 6, 7, 8 hours a day. And that much of anything is having an impact, partly just because of what else isn't being done, the social interaction that's not being done, the thinking, the creative play that's not being done. But it also has its own impact that's just specific to this medium. And some of the really repetitive games, for instance, cause the brain almost, as psychologists explained it to me in sort of very simple terms, it almost causes the brain to shut down. It goes into sort of a repetitive loop. And it's problematic because some of the results are really high levels of anxiety, increased frustration among kids. These things spill off into their relationships with their siblings, into school, into their relationships with the parents. And the reason that I think that a lot of kids are getting away with playing as much as they are is because video games are so new. And the studies haven't been done to prove what, to me, the anecdotal evidence proves conclusively that these things are have an enormous amount of power in kids' lives. Kids mimic what they see on the screens in their play. It affects the way that they perceive problems. A psychologist on a panel was talking about violence in video games, and he was saying that among older children, the violence in video games may not be that significant. Kids can tell the difference between real violence and cartoon violence. But in much younger children, he's done studies with kids who play a lot of video games against a control group of kids who are just watching television and doing other normal, in quotes, kid activities. And the kids who are playing a lot of video games will come to a problem, to the same problem as these other kids, and confront it with a very, very limited amount of creativity. For instance, a boy has an apple, and the other child wants the apple. What's the child going to do? Well, the control group of kids will come up with an enormous amount of possibilities. Can I have a bite of the apple? Can I have half the apple? Can I trade you something for the apple? When you're finished with having some of the apple, can I have the rest of it? These kids who have been playing video games a lot will come up with two or three options. Take the apple, give up, or maybe something else. But that's a fundamental difference in the way that these kids are being shaped, and it's going to affect them in everything.
My boys, when you're got one of the versions of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, and that was one of my first experiences, just watching them play it. And I was pretty amazed because the turtles are doing all these kinds of things, and the girl in it, all April got to do was be saved. I mean, it was indignant. You know, you were saying earlier, most of these games are oriented toward boys. Is that still the case?
It is the case, and it causes a whole other series of problems. What sells video games is more than anything else these companies can do, more than advertising and more than more than any other factor, is coolness. And what becomes cool for younger kids is what's cool for older kids, and what's cool for older kids becomes what's cool for the even older kids, the teenage kids, who are playing video games in arcades. And in arcades, you can walk into arcades, and if there are girls there, they're looking over the boys' shoulders, unfortunately, and almost always. I mean, there certainly are some girl players who are great and devoted, but it's a small number. And as a result, girls are not only are they left out of whatever education is going on here, and maybe it's a good thing for them, but they're also it's really not just reinforcing but creating some new stereotypes. First of all, as you say, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, but I could also list about 100 other games that are about saving a girl in distress, and some of them are far, far more brutal than even the worst of television. There's a new game called Night Trap, in which girls are not just kidnapped, but they're tortured. They're chained up against a wall, and drills are sort of slowly injected into their necks and things like that. I mean, it's pretty brutal and pretty, you know, just it's pretty incredible. And so, in terms of you know, reinforcing all the stereotypes that we're, you know, trying to do something about, I mean, these games are back to the dark ages. The other thing is that in games, in a lot of games, girls are present for instance, in Street Fighter II, which was the most popular selling game last year, the biggest selling game last year. There's one girl fighter, but mostly the game is about these big, brutal guys bashing each other, basically. And when you get good, you can get your guy to jump on his opponent's head and start biting his skull until blood starts spurting out. And
how attractive.
It's great. But the girls in the game are sitting on the sidelines wearing their bikinis, and they're sort of dancing and cheering the guys on. And so the companies all of a sudden saw, well, wait a second, we've pretty much saturated the market of boys out there, so how are we going to win over more girls? And so they've actually been going after girls in the last couple of years, and Nintendo's fastest growing market segment right now are girls. And they've done it by pushing some of the less violent games, some of the puzzle games and things like that, and also sort of insultingly coming out with games that are, oh, I don't know, like a bad knockoff of Barbie doll in video game form, or My Little Pony, The Little Mermaid is now a video game, and things like that, designed to go after girls. It's a pretty callous marketing decision, and it's not being done, because somebody has come up with this great, inspiring sort of creative program that also happens to appeal to girls. It's being done because there are more dollars to be made.
My guest today is David Sheff, author of Game Over, a book about Nintendo, the company itself, and its impact on America. I'm Ira Gunn, and you're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Let's turn for a little bit to, as you said, dollars to be made, to the business end of Nintendo. One of the keys to Nintendo's success had been the control of both the system and the games themselves. How did that work?
Yeah, it is the sole reason that Nintendo makes more money than almost any other company you can think of, more money than Apple or Microsoft or all the movie studios combined or some of the other, I sort of rattled off in the book a lot of statistics, because it is a new way to tackle an industry. It is not just selling the hardware, but it is controlling, completely controlling the software. It is as if one company was selling VCRs, but also either selling or controlling the rental of every movie that played on them. The VCR business right now is about an $11 billion a year industry, and it's as if one company was controlling that whole thing. In computers, there's a different model. If I want to go out and start a company and create a piece of software that would run on a Macintosh computer or on an IBM PC, I can do that. If I wanted to make a video game that would play on Nintendo's system or perhaps the Sega system, which is Nintendo's big competitor, I couldn't do it. There is proprietary technology in those systems that stops me from doing it. And secondly, there are all kinds of licensing agreements that are required. Because the industry has been set up that way, Nintendo is not only are they making an enormous amount of money, in fact, I think it was over $1.6 billion last year in profits, but also they are dictating the businesses of other companies. If you want to work with Nintendo, you play by their rules. They tell you which games you can produce, how many games you can produce, how you can market their games. The benefit is sizable, too. You have a marketplace that is insatiable. There are about 35 million Nintendo systems in American homes right now, and so a lot of software companies are making a lot of money. But it also means that a lot of smaller software companies can't get in because it costs so much to get in. You have to not only pay licensing fees and all, but you have to buy technology from Nintendo, which means you have to actually buy chips, computer chips, so that your cartridges can play in the Nintendo machine. And that means that Nintendo is making money coming and going. And as a result, there's a lot of companies that have been frustrated in trying to get involved in that industry.
Still, there have been a number of lawsuits which might have broken Nintendo's hold on the market, but didn't. Tell us what happened there.
Nintendo has been it's almost been unbelievable how they've managed to sort of walk the line of what is acceptable business practice in America. They have been investigated by the Federal Trade Commission and by the Justice Department and by different Congress people. They've been sued by a dozen companies at least, probably more. There have been a couple examples of cases where Nintendo has lost, but very, very few. Almost always, Nintendo manages to get through these things unscathed, and it's a testament to how smart they are. They cover all their bases, and they do a good job they've succeeded because of a number of things. One of them is because they came in with a great product. Secondly, they are marketers par excellence. I mean, they have shaken up not just marketing of video or games or computers in America, but any company. They have they're amazing in the way that they've done their marketing. They cover all bases. But they also have had a control on the industry that is pretty unusual. And that's where they've been criticized, and that's where they've been accused of operating a monopoly and accused of restraining other people's business. But they've always walked through these things almost, as I said, unscathed. And some of it is a testament to the way that people have attacked them. For instance, the original Atari ended up breaking up into a lot of little companies, and one of them, Atari Games, a software company, decided to go after Nintendo, and after originally gaining a license, they tried to break the Nintendo stronghold by illegally copying Nintendo's some of its copyrighted technology. If they had done that legally, and if they had done it on their own without stealing secrets, essentially, then they probably would have won a major lawsuit against Nintendo, but they didn't. The judge found, and there was lots of evidence to prove, that Atari Games had literally stolen copyright that allowed their games to work on the Nintendo machine. So they didn't have a chance in their suit. The Federal Trade Commission ended up, in one of their investigations of Nintendo, was for price fixing. And there was a lot of occasions where Nintendo representatives, even if it wasn't a corporate policy, there were Nintendo representatives who were engaging in some form of price fixing. People told me stories that I recount in the book. But after a year-long investigation against Nintendo, the FTC ended up settling with Nintendo. And so Nintendo never had to admit that they were guilty. And as penance for this supposed price fixing, or for whatever they didn't do, or whatever they never had to admit that they were doing, they had to send out to all their customers $5 coupons, so that essentially they send out 20 million at the time, perhaps, coupons for good for $5 off your next purchase of a Nintendo game. So as penalty for doing something that you're not supposed to do in this country, they were forced, in quotes, to do this great marketing scheme. So kids all over the country took their $5 coupon and went down to the store, bought a $50 Nintendo game. They got $5 off, and Nintendo still made money.
Ooh, hit me again.
That's
Give
right.
me another penalty.
That's right, exactly.
I was fascinated when I read about Nintendo Power Magazine and some of the other cross promotions with Pepsi and Tide laundry detergent and McDonald's and a 30-city Nintendo Power Fest. What are all these things?
It's part of the Nintendo marketing loop, which leaves no stone unturned. These guys sat around and they talked about that, and they talked about it and talked about it, and they interviewed kids and they interviewed toy store owners, and they spent an enormous amount of time researching things before they launched their business here. They did things like, video games sort of had a bad image because they were kind of tied to video games and arcades and kind of tied to pool tables. And so there was something a little bit racy about them, and so they weren't sure that parents were going to welcome them into their homes. So they tied to products like Tide and Pepsi and sort of all-American products, and pretty soon when you bought a McDonald's Happy Meal or something like that, you got Nintendo characters inside, which, of course, the kids wanted. So kids were inundated with Nintendo, and there were Nintendo breakfast cereals and Nintendo bed sheets, and it goes down the line. Nintendo Magazine, Nintendo Power, it's called, became the biggest circulation magazine for children, a magazine that came out monthly that kids paid for, that became a Bible for kids because it was the key to winning some of the tough Nintendo games. It told you how to beat Morton Koopa Jr. or how to kill Wart or how to get through the seventh level of The Legend of Zelda when you just couldn't figure out how to do battle with one of the warriors there or something like that. So this magazine, teachers told me this, that kids who would not read a page of schoolwork were poring over every single word of Nintendo Power magazine. Similar to Nintendo Power, there are the Nintendo Game Counselors. When you get really stuck and you can't figure out something in a game, even with the magazine, you call Seattle. They've got about 300 to 500, I think it is, guys sitting around in front of computer terminals and Nintendo games whose job it is to do nothing but play games and to give kids tips on how to play. So a child will be stuck and he'll call up Nintendo and they'll have a conversation with these game counselors, and the game counselors will find out from the kids what they like and what they don't like, and that information will be filtered into their R&D divisions. And they'll also tell the kids, well, wait till you see the sequel to this game. Super Mario World is coming out soon, and it's playable on the new 16-bit Nintendo system, which has three dimensions, and it's got far better graphics. And pretty soon, the frenzy that's anticipating the next game is unbelievable.
So Nintendo publishes Nintendo Power Magazine.
Yep. They publish the magazine and use their database of Nintendo buyers. When you buy a Nintendo system, in order to get a free copy of Nintendo Power Magazine, you turn in a warranty card. And once they've got your name on their mailing list, then you are theirs. the other half of Nintendo Power Magazine is nothing but a promotion for new Nintendo games. So kids were paying for this magazine that would help them get through the games, and then the rest of the magazine was devoted to selling them the next game. So the next game would come out, and there was this enormous audience. So video games came out, and when Nintendo came out in 1985 in America, they sold for about 1 million systems within the first year and a half, I think it was, or maybe it was 2 years. Then they sold 5 million within the year after that. After that, they'd sold 20 million. By 1990, they'd sold about 30 million systems. Video games would come in to the marketplace, and there was such demand that a successful game would sell 500,000, but a really successful game would sell 1 million, 2, 3 million copies. Super Mario Brothers 3, the third sequel to Super Mario, sold 7 million copies in America alone. Overall, it sold about 11 million copies, and every one of those games cost about $50 each. So I compared it to the movie business. No movie except for E.T. has grossed as much as Super Mario 3. That's what is at stake, and that's the way they did it. They did it by leaving no stone unturned, as I said.
My guest today has been David Sheff. He is author of the book Game Over, Nintendo Zapped an American Industry, Captured Your Dollars, and Enslaved Your Children. It's published by Random House. You're listening to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology. Barry Evans' perspective today is called Wiring the World.
When I consider monumental works of humankind, I think of the Great Pyramid, the Eiffel Tower, the Statue of Liberty, Mount Rushmore's presidents, the Saturn V rocket, Panama Canal, Boulder Dam, and Perry Collins' Overland Telegraph. Now, the last mentioned doesn't usually make the top 10 or even the top 100 list for one good reason. It wasn't finished. Started, yes, but stopped in midstream. And not because it wouldn't have succeeded, but because it was preempted by another wild scheme that did. In the middle of the last century, with communication between Europe and America only as fast as the speediest sailing ships, several entrepreneurs dreamed of a telegraph line linking the old world with the new. After the failure of several attempts to lay an undersea cable across the Atlantic, Perry McDonoghue Collins, a well-traveled American businessman with good connections in both Washington and St. Petersburg, conceived of building an overland telegraph via Asia. Collins' plan was to extend the newly built transcontinental telegraph line up the West Coast into the interior of British Columbia, through Russian America, what would become Alaska, across the 52-mile-wide Bering Strait to the mouth of the Amur River. From there, it would run 5,000 miles across Siberia to Moscow, St. Petersburg, and the rest of Europe. After years of negotiations, Collins' crews started construction in 1865. And by summer of the following year, the Canadian and Russian sections were well on their way to completion. And given the rapid rate of construction, the telegraph would have been fully operational within a couple of years. Fate intervened, in the form of Cyrus Field, another bold entrepreneur. Field had failed in his first attempt to lay an undersea cable across the Atlantic in 1857. A year later, he failed again. Finally, he leased the Great Eastern, a ship five times larger than any other afloat at its launching in 1858. On its third attempt, the Great Eastern succeeded in connecting America to Europe by copper cable. And in July 1866, the first message was sent across the Atlantic from Cape Clear Island to Heart's Content, Newfoundland. 8 months later, with the transatlantic cable still working, work came to a halt on Collins' overland line. One lasting consequence of Collins' aborted scheme was to put Russian America onto the map and into the consciousness of the government of the United States. Without Collins' vision, Alaska might still belong to Russia. The Overland Telegraph, in my mind, ranks as one of the boldest, most imaginative proposals ever made. It would surely have succeeded had not another equally bold and imaginative proposal succeeded first, an undersea telegraph across the Atlantic.
Barry Evans is the author of the syndicated column Star Watch. His most recent book is Everyday Wonders, Encounters with the Astonishing World Around Us. For Tech Nation, I'm Moira Gunn.
This broadcast was brought to you in part by the Tech Museum of Innovation in San Jose, California. The Tech is dedicated to the spirit of innovation in Silicon Valley and throughout the world. Associate producer for Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is Monte Carlos. Recording engineers are Howard Gelman, Ed Herman, and Seal Muller. The music direction is by Sean Breen, with original music composition by San Francisco songwriters. Title creation provided by NameLab Incorporated of San Francisco. If you'd like a cassette tape or to receive a complete program catalog, call 1-800-959-3430. That's 1-800-959-3430. Send your written comments to Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, Post Office Box 590-607, San Francisco, California, 94159. This program was produced at the studios of KQED-FM in San Francisco. Tech Nation, Americans and Technology, is a production of MogoTech Media.